What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. We are so excited to be joined by you. We have such a great show tonight. We have really great guests for you, and they are perfect to discuss some breaking news. Before we start, though, please do give this stream a thumbs up. That's a really great way to support this for free. It helps bring more people to the stream, and you'll see why that's so important when I bring on tonight's guests. But again, our guests are such experts, and they talk about such important things. And if you can become Patreon supporters, please do that at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. We will be dropping next week a very cool nugget of an interview that I did with Jeremy Corbyn. And there are tons of bonus interviews and extra interviews and extended interviews that you'll get once you are Patreon supporters. And that is at the $5 a month level. And if you can't afford that, you can become a $1 a month level. That's $12 a year. And you still get to make this show happen. So both levels are extremely appreciated. So we're going to bring on the first guest. And I'm so excited for her to be coming back onto the show. It is such an honor always to be talking to her. And that person is Noura Erekat, who is a human rights attorney, associate professor of Africana Studies and the Program of Criminal Justice at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. Noura is also the author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, which received the Palestine Book Award and the Bronze Medal for the Independent Publishers Book Award in Current Events Foreign Affairs. She's co-founding editor of Jadalia and an editorial board member of the Journal of Palestine Studies, as well as Human Geography. So Noura, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Katie. Nice to be back.
Thank you.
I wish we were talking about something else.
Right. Yeah. It would be nice if we weren't still talking about an ongoing genocide. But here we are. And actually, I want to ask you about some relatively breaking news, mm-hmm. which is that the U.S., I'm reading at the AP, U.S. charges Hamas leader, other militants in connection with October 7th massacre in Israel. The Justice Department announced criminal charges Tuesday against Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar and other senior militants in connection with the October 7th, 2023 rampage in Israel, marking the first effort by American law enforcement to formally call out the masterminds of the attack. So what are your thoughts on this, Noura, as a human rights attorney?
Yeah, this is really, you know, this is really difficult to stomach in light of the ongoing impunity for Israel, for Israeli officers, for the covering up of Netanyahu, who's being protested by his own defense minister, and an popular upheaval. And the U.S. is covering for Netanyahu. And in the midst of this chronic lack of accountability and participation in a genocide, now the U.S. is mobilizing its own domestic criminal order to further prosecute Hamas, which is already designated as a terrorist organization by the State Department, which means all the sanctions that the U.S. can apply have already been applied. That punitive edge of the law has already been wielded. And so, I think at once my immediate reaction to this is that this is not surprising at all. And yet, because it completely fits in line step with the U.S.'s policy on this issue, with its doublespeak, but it's nevertheless incredulous and infuriating in light of the ongoing genocide for 11 months, which has now, you know, every time you think that it can't get worse, it gets worse. Images get more harrowing. The lack, you know, at first, one can say there was a debate happening. There was the fog of war, so to speak, and we couldn't see things clearly. And so there was a lot of, you know, combative back and forth in terms of what's happening at the diplomatic, the political, and the media level. And yet now everything is known. In fact, they've told us in their own words. Israeli leaders have been very clear that they don't think that there are innocents there. We have seen very clearly that this isn't about collateral damage and attempts to target a Hamas militant, but instead, doctors have said that they've received babies with two sniper bullets to the head. We have discovered mass graves with Palestinian patients and doctors whose hands have been zip tied. We have seen with our own eyes video footage of sexual assault and gang rape of Palestinians in detention. We have heard from Israel itself backtrack on nearly all of the allegations that they made about beheaded babies, about women who were disemboweled in the moment of the attack. We've understood that the attack has happened by Israeli officers themselves who have ordered the attack on their Israeli civilians because of the doctrine. I'm for the Hannibal Doctrine, which basically stipulates that in order to avoid another incident of a captured soldier, as was the case with Shalit, that it would be better to altogether kill the captive and everybody around them. We have that evidence too. They have told us, right? And so it's now we're at this point and at this juncture where not only do we know all this, I mean, it's hard for me to put into words, like, who are they lying to? Who are they lying to? And is there anybody actually being lied to? Or is it that there's just a collusion across the board of those who are ardent, you know, Zionists who support Israel, together with, you know, powers that be who are benefiting either from profits that are coming from an ongoing war, right? Thinking about our military industrial complex, about the largest weapons manufacturers who benefit from logistics, as well as from sales, as well as from reconstruction. I mean, they're winning all around as long as this continues. And so it leaves one to really, you know, be vexed at this point that what are they asking us to do? How are we supposed to respond in this moment if it's so transparent and so obvious? What right. political process are we supposed to participate in, if any, in order to redress these atrocities, I mean, mass atrocities of genocide, of a colonial genocide on a scale we have never witnessed in real time before?
Right. And you and I spoke very briefly before we went live, and you mentioned the double standard, for instance, in the fact that the U.S. isn't doing anything about the Netzah Yehuda battalion, even though they said that they were going to, despite the fact that these people killed a Palestinian American, and they can't do the slightest.
If one has the gall, right, to talk about their feelings, like as in this moment, the feeling is we keep getting reminded, especially as Palestinians, by state and society, that they do not believe we are human. Full stop. I mean, full stop. They just do not believe we are human. Had they believed we are human, obviously there would be some sort of empathy for 15,000 babies killed, right? There would be, you know, a modicum of that for now 40,000 Palestinians killed. There would be a modicum of that empathy, but they're going even beyond that when they're making clear that everything that we've seen with our eyes, right, and everything that Palestinians have endured and continue to endure right now in Jenin, having your father kidnapped, tortured, and brought back dead without accountability, knowing that three-year-olds can be picked up by military jeeps, or that military jeeps can run over Palestinians, and there's no accountability and no one looking. And yet the message that people are you know, the greatest form of, you know, they're telling us that we're not human, is that all of that can happen to us. And you can watch all of that and you still don't believe that we have the right to resist by any means necessary to protect ourselves? Have you lost your minds? I mean, the most dehumanizing thing is to see all that and to tell Palestinians suffer and in fact be polite about it. That is the greatest form of dehumanization. That's how we know they don't think we're human, because nobody would endure this. Nobody should endure this, right? And so, yeah, I mean, on that level, just everything that's happening, the rhetoric, the fact that Israeli society is in upheaval, angry at Netanyahu demanding a ceasefire deal in order to retrieve their captives. And yet, not a word, unless I'm missing something on some stage happening somewhere, not a single word on the number of Palestinians who have been slaughtered, not a single word about a single baby. So here's a society that also just, this isn't about us. This could have gone on for 24 more months as far as they were concerned, as if it doesn't affect them and who they are, right? And then to see, you know, the highest levels of government then come out expressing empathy for those who are killed in a way that just makes it even more stark that you haven't said anything. I mean, on 100 days, Biden did the same thing when 10,000 babies had been killed. Children, I'm calling them babies, when 10,000 children had been killed, and he said nothing then. I mean, this is endemic. So obviously, yes. And then just to think about the application of U.S. law, just a comment on that. Yes, obviously, the Netzach Yehuda Brigade, which is the lowest hanging fruit in order to apply the Leahy law, right? Which basically stipulates there's a number of U.S. laws that condition the provision of U.S. military support, weapons, assistance, intelligence, and so on the fact that the belligerent recipient or the state or whatever recipient is receiving them is complying with certain laws, including laws of war, basic laws of war, the ones that are not contentious, and U.S. law, right? And yet in that instance, and that battalion, which is notorious, killed a 78-year-old Palestinian American who was visiting. And yet they didn't take that opportunity. Forget mobilizing your federal prosecutors. Over here, I mean, you could have applied the Leahy law. And they said it and then took it back because of pressure that somehow they're just gonna, you know, walk in lockstep. But even, I mean, think about before that. If you remember, in 2014, after the burning alive of Muhammad Khadir in a forest, okay, this is still seared in our minds, right? Where does this amount of violence go, right? Tariq Khadir, his, you know, relative, is beat up by Israeli officers, like comes back, face bruised up, eyes. I don't know if you want to pull up the image. There's no accountability for Tariq. Shirin Abu Akleh is an American citizen, a journalist, emblazoned with a journalist press vest, right? Who was sniped in the early mornings in Jenin beneath her helmet and her ear, where her ear was exposed. It was obviously deliberate. Nothing. There are Palestinian Americans who are not evacuated in Gaza, who have been harmed. I mean, it's just really, it feels like a loss. I feel stupid, frankly, to be putting this into words when, as far as I'm concerned, the situation is screaming for itself. It's not speaking for itself. It's screaming for itself. And so I know I'm obviously talking to an ally here, And it makes sense to have this conversation. But in other spaces, when you're asking us to comment on this, one has to wonder, for what? Have you not seen? Are you not paying attention? And then worse, if you're in certain institutions, like at universities, where they're now, telling professors, don't even teach this, right? Violate your, as Professor Maya McDashi has put there, asking us to violate our own commitment to pedagogy and teaching and knowledge production in order to fit within this political project of annihilation, right? It's mind baffling. And I think what's coming across increasingly more clear is that we're also in a moment of a counter-revolution, of, entrenching, that all of these gains that have been made over the 11 months in order to expose, in order to show, in order to debunk, in order to mobilize, in order to, move lawsuits, in order to, I brought, you talk about non-compliance with the U.S. law, national security memorandum, like all of this momentum and energy that has pushed really the U.S. and Israel into a corner and into isolation, right? Rather than that just becoming very evident so that we can push them all the way, over that edge. Instead, it's a counter-revolutionary moment where they're doubling down. They're doubling down, where media is resurrecting tired, tired talking points about, that 40,000 Palestinians are collateral damage because of Hamas. I mean, really? Right. When there's you have seen that there are no safe zones. You cannot have collateral damage if civilians have nowhere to shelter. And even if you think somehow Hamas just appears in every shelter that Israel intended to maintain, right? There is an obligation on belligerent states, according to the first additional protocol, which regulates precisely this type of asymmetric, warfare, which, if we are to understand it as warfare, which basically mandates that the belligerent states shall desist from an operation where the civilian cost is excessive. At what point do you agree that it has become excessive, right? And so you see media doubling down, like they're resurrecting these talking points that we shamed them from using. I saw us shame them from using it. And then last week, a BBC commentator used it with me. And get this, that interview that I was doing, I thought was going to be about the ceasefire, right? Instead, it was about a humanitarian outbreak. Well, okay, how do you discuss a humanitarian crisis in Gaza right now that doesn't talk about the fact that Israel has destroyed shelters, that Israel has destroyed hospitals, that Israel has contaminated water, that Israel has limited access to life-saving services, right? In response to me wanting to talk about that, I mean, how did polio
not just re-emerge? A natural disaster.
No, polio reemerges because water has been contaminated. This correspondent wanted to explain that it's because Palestinians are, dumping their sewage into water sources. Why would they be dumping their sewage? What happened to their bathrooms? What happened to their homes? Who destroyed access to potable water? In response to me trying to just point out what I thought was quite basic, he comes back and says, it's really unfortunate there isn't an Israeli to respond to you right now. And I just want to point out that Israelis do not think that any of that is true. I was shocked in that moment. I've rarely been shocked in an interview. I was shocked in that moment in a way where I couldn't respond as quickly as I wanted. But then I saw on other programs, it looks like BBC policy. They're doing it across the board to anybody who comes on. It's very similar to DW, the German network. They do the same thing, right? They've gotten policy. But we see that there. We see universities in their counter-revolutionary moment, that rather than now, okay, you're right. There are no universities left. We've had to admit these students because their universities have been destroyed. They might not even have a transcript, right? Instead, they're creating new policy that basically says that being a Zionist is a protected class and their non-discrimination, you know, protocols as at NYU or at other universities like UCLA, where masks and encampments are illegal, or at other universities where basically you have to apply for a free expression permit to basically, you know, they're basically equating protest to theater, right? Say what it, like, free speech is not the ability to just speak. The reason, the utility of free speech is to be able to impact and change an oppressive status quo. That is the purpose of it. It's not so everybody knows my opinion, right? I can tell my, you know, that's not what matters. That's not why it's threatening.
When you mentioned the BBC protocol, you mean that they are saying they have to have an Israeli on, or they have
No. First of all, let's be clear. I haven't seen that this is official protocol. I have seen a recent trend whereby BBC correspondents with their Palestinian guests or with guests that are basically making an argument to stop a genocide, right, are saying, we want to make clear that Israel would not say this and that they reject that there is genocide. And when I use the part that they reject, they wouldn't use the word apartheid. It's like, okay, why? What are you doing? Who cares what they would say?
Also, I mean, the idea that they would say it's Palestinians like contaminating their own water just gives away how, like, you keep talking about the dehumanization. I mean, they clearly see them/you as,
that's right,
like, dirty.
Absolutely me. But the cause of our own suffering. I mean, right. that's what it comes down. You know, I was thinking about this, thinking about what's proximate to people that they can maybe understand this, right? Like, thinking about the families, like somebody with, you know, the families of incarcerated people, even in the United States, right? When you think about them, your first, unfortunately for most people, their first reaction is not empathy, right, for someone whose family, whose beloved is incarcerated. The first reaction is, oh, what did they do?
Right.
Right? You want to know. You want to know if they deserved being encaged, right? Forget the fact that maybe they had done nothing, but the system, you know, is rigged, or that there are structural, you know, the criminal justice system, or that the structural conditions that led to this place, or the fact that cops wield a tremendous amount of power and are an extension of state violence and can use that power in order, you know, to pursue their own personal ends, right? None of that matters. All that matters is they want to know, what did they do? Right. And so I was thinking, you know, in the same way, there is a way in which a mass American public and a European public, I would guess, I'm not in Europe, but I've gone during this time twice. And so spoken there, but that there is an assumption that Palestinians deserve this. We have done something to deserve this. Had we just been more polite, right? Had we been more quiet, had we been less violent, right? But there was something about us, like a congenital,
more civilized. Disorder.
Had we been civilized, right? That this wouldn't happen. So that there's a block to getting to where you need to understand that the babies that you're watching being slaughtered into pieces, who have to be put into rice bags by kilogram in order to be buried, right? We're never granted the presumption of innocence.
Right.
And we see a U.S. state and society that's acting upon that racist basis. But worse, in order to hammer that point home to those who don't believe it anymore, now we see the state mobilizing in order to criminalize further. That this is so bad, right? That this young man who was killed, I forget his last name, Hirsch, yeah, right? The Israeli hostage that was killed now becomes part of all of our lives and our homes in a way that our prosecutors are going to respond.
Hirsch Goldberg, Poland.
Say it again, Hirsch Goldberg, Poland.
Goldberg, Poland, or Poland, yeah.
Goldberg. And obviously, none of this is to negate his, you know, loss of life, right, and the pain his family feels, or how, you know, hard that must be. But the way that it's done is not merely because of a concern for his life or a concern for any of these captives' lives. I mean, if we cared, then you would care about now the 21,000 Palestinians who are held captive and hostage, right? There's just, it's not, it's the weaponization of it. It's the mobilization of it so cynically that in its mobilization is also emphasizing not only giving a green light for Israel to continue a genocidal campaign in the midst of a presidential election where they want to tell us that somehow there's anything different happening here. But that's going so far as to, in narrating that story, is emphasizing to an audience that Palestinians aren't human. They were never human. That's why nobody talks about them. They have no human life to return to. There was no dignity, right? You know, it's such a deep, you know, I study this all the time in literature on colonialism and the use of law in order to effectuate this, on critical race theory. And it's one thing to teach this, to read this, to study it theoretically, and then to watch its most horrific, frankly, its most horrific manifestation happen in real time in ways that we can barely keep up with.
Right. And, you know, I just wanted to actually show the Kamala Harris response to the death of the hostage who we just mentioned, Hirsch Goldberg-Polin. And his parents have spoke at the DNC. Here's what she said. Just so people are caught up, Israel announced that it had recovered the bodies of 6 Israeli hostages that had been held by Hamas in Gaza, and Israel is saying the hostages were murdered by Hamas, and Hamas is saying they were killed by Israeli airstrikes. So here is how Kamala Harris responded to this news. On October 7th, Hirsch Goldberg-Polin, an American citizen, was taken hostage by Hamas terrorists. He was just 23 years old, attending music festivals. Friends, we now know he was murdered by Hamas. His body was recovered in the tunnels under Rafah, along with 5 other hostages. Doug and my prayers are with John Polin and Rachel Goldberg-Polin, Hirsch's parents, and with everyone who knew and loved Hirsch. When I met with John and Rachel earlier this year, I told them you are not alone. That remains true as they mourn this terrible loss. Americans and people around the world will pray for John, Rachel, and their family and send them love and strength. As is said in the Jewish tradition, may Hirsch's memory be a blessing. Hamas is an evil terrorist organization. With these murders, Hamas has even more American blood on its hands. I strongly condemn Hamas's continued brutality, and so must the entire world. So, and again, like you said, Noura, like, this is not to say that it's not a tragedy for this family, but have we ever seen anything comparable about the death of a Palestinian or a Palestinian American?
Oh, I didn't even know you were going to go there. Absolutely not. No. I think, and even here, like the pulling on evil, yeah. Right? So both of, just looking at this language, right? The fact of pulling on evil and pulling on terrorists, both of them are slurs that are used in this context. Because if we were going to use, first of all, evil is in reference to, you know, to a moral question, right? To morality altogether, right? There's an evilness, and you might even pull on religion. Terrorism, in its textbook definition, refers to the targeting of civilians in order to achieve a political outcome. If we are going to use that language for this purpose, then it would have been used to describe all of Israel's operations, which they have made very, and even the trolls on Twitter who come at every single thing that we say about, you know, ceasefire now, and they respond, if you really cared, you would want to release the hostages. Even they're telling us all the time, we will keep killing your children until the hostages are released. They're basically saying, we will continue to engage in terrorist attacks until you do XYZ. And they have been doing it for 333 days, and not once has it been described as terrorism. Not once has it been described as evil. And that's just the past 333 days without like reference to the past decade. So I just, you know, the fact that then she, who wants to come, who has told, you know, and her team in her camp has said that she is not Biden and wants to change the policy and just can't abrogate, you know, none of that's true. All of that's BS, right? But the fact that she will come up and say that We are working tirelessly for a ceasefire. Who do you think is negotiating the ceasefire? Who are they negotiating with? Obviously, this very organization that you have, this political party that you call an organization, they were elected into office in 2006. They were never given their mandate to govern, but they are the government, right? They should be dealt with as a sovereign, a nascent sovereign coming into being, right? And yet, they have a military arm, but that's not all that they do. And yet by framing them as such, now suddenly it evacuates any kind of analysis where we don't use scrutiny in order to evaluate them as a political project, where we don't understand them as a rational player. I mean, obviously they're a rational player given the decisions that they've made in the past few years. And even now, as they're negotiating, it evacuates the possibility to understand that Hamas as a political movement, like what are they? What do they stand for? How did they come about? And how is it that they can't be defeated militarily? Because those ideas, the broadest swaths of their ideas, are almost uniformly held amongst Palestinians, which is Palestinians deserve liberation. Most Palestinians are anti-Zionist, and we have the right to use force to defend ourselves. So by using this language, there's this broad brush that anything that echoes these sentiments now also becomes evil and terroristic in a way that has to be destroyed through brute force, right? There's so much work going on there so fast in a way that's making it incredibly easy, as we're seeing and will continue to see, people to harass somebody wearing a keffiyeh to say, you support Hamas, right? They're not saying you support Palestinians, right? They're saying you support, because the move here is to basically collapse support for Palestinian freedom, right? And if you want to do maybe you don't believe in Palestinian freedom, but you certainly don't think babies should be slaughtered, or people who want that to stop, suddenly all of that is equated to some immorality and criminal activity. This is the counter-revolutionary moment that we're seeing ourselves in. And I would encourage folks, you know, don't cower. Don't cower. This is an indication of their weakness, where they're pulling on some absurdity in this moment. And it's incumbent upon us to basically keep on, push back harder. They say, you know, Zionist is a protected class. Zionist is a political ideology. There are more Christian Zionists than there are Jewish Zionists. Stop it. Like, what are you doing? How are you going to then tell and then talk about some democracy? That's some authoritarianism, right? Where what, even here in the freedom of speech, even saying what you will, we can't even like say it, and you're not going to talk about it. So
yeah, it's so disgusting. It's like, I can't even, every time I'm shocked, I can't believe, or every time I think nothing will shock me, I'm still shocked, because the levels of hypocrisy and dehumanization, and also kind of the Twilight Zone aspect of it. Like every week I bring this up, but I just still can't get over the fact that, and again, I'm being naive, but cannot get over the fact that Jake Tapper, Dana Bash talked about Hamas raping people. And we have video, as you referred to earlier, video of sexual assault, video of rape. We know from Israeli media and, of course, Israeli human rights organizations, not to speak of, obviously, Palestinian witnesses, but we know it's documented that there's been rape committed by Israelis. We've seen protests for defending the right to rape, basically. We've seen Knesset members saying it's legitimate to insert sticks into someone's rectum. And where are the media, the correspondents, where's CNN on this? How, if they care about rape, how could they be silent about this?
They do not. And so this goes back to, and it's the same thing when Harris said the same thing, right? She wanted to talk about Israel and about, like, you know, mass rapes on October 7th. if you're going to talk about sexual assault, then talk about it in principle. First of all, there hasn't been evidence that's been forthcoming where you can say it with your chest out like that, right? And it even looks worse when you're completely silent on what all of us have seen. When Bit Selim, right?
Right.
Publishes, you know, so 100+ page report.
Welcome to hell.
Yeah. That's based on testimony of the Israeli officers themselves. And you're just not going to say anything. At this point, it should be clear to those of us, right? It should be clear to those of us who are paying attention that all of these are methods of propaganda that are used to further racialize the evil other, right? This trope of being afraid, it's not about a principle against sexual assault or even acknowledging that, for example, sexual assault is endemic in armed conflict. And if we are going to take it seriously, then take it seriously, right? But that instead it's being used basically to say that we have to protect our women from these savage brown others. Right now, women get used as, you know, their bodies now become the national border in order to mobilize an entire society. And what happens is that this brown other who is accused of sexual assault commits sexual assault with a lustfulness that's so unique that they're out of control. They're animalistic, you know, unlike other rational actors who are impacted by power and domination, which is why sexual assault is endemic in armed conflict, because of the dimension of power. And yet not only forget, I mean, I'm having a theoretical discussion because none of this has been forthcoming, but let's say it was, right? Let's say it was. In that instance, it should be evaluated in a way that understands that the problem is an issue of power, and that the problem is an issue of militarization, and the problem is an issue of being able to dominate, which needs to be undone. And instead, nothing that can be productive in order to lead us to a resolution. Instead, it's mobilized primarily in order to further racist tropes that Palestinians are not the only ones to endure, right? There's a new movie about Emmett Till.
Right. Someone just mentioned that in the comments. Yeah. Emmett Till, the Scottsboro Boys. Yeah.
All of it. Lynching, and the endemic nature of lynching as a weapon of domination is all mobilized with this trope, with the hypersexualization of Black men and the idea in order to protect women. I mean, there is a legacy of this, and it's a very much a colonial trope, right? Well, we're not going in order to extract land and labor, and in order, you know, to have access to these seaports and this land, you know, passage. We're going in because we want to protect women,
right, from these monsters. I believe you have a class to teach, so is this when we should end right now because you have a class?
Yeah. I mean, if you want to do a quick last question, maybe, and I'll tell you if I can answer it, but yeah, I do need to run.
How about what can be done about what's happening on campuses, given the fact that, for instance, NYU is trying to declare Zionism a protected class, and given all the repression we've seen against student protests, what is your advice as a professor? And by the way, you are full professor. Congrats. You're not associate professor. That was outdated. Full professor, as a professor and also as a human rights attorney, what is your advice for people who want to be protesting?
Yeah, this one is hard. So there's no advice that I can give that's going to fit necessarily across the board. And I think every university, every student body needs to evaluate their campus differently. It's far, 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 for example, more more aggressive at UCLA, for example, and at Columbia than it might be at Northeastern, right? It's going to be different levels of it. There might be administrations that want to cooperate. So, and I say this to emphasize that in this moment, I really, really encourage students and fellow faculty and everyone out there to not just react, to the moment and we're entitled to this anger and this emotion, but to also think strategically, what is it that we want to achieve in this moment? What is the greatest thing we can achieve? What is the least thing? What can be an incremental achievement that will lead us to, for example, on a 5-year plan that would, you know, that would basically set, or a 4-year plan that would set up the next incoming class, you know, full turnover in the incoming class of freshmen, you know, and think just like think a little bit far ahead in that way of what is it that we're achieving? How much space can you take on campus without being completely shut? That's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to, you know, do everything that you can in order to point out the contradictions, but that depends on your circumstances, if that's what you want to do. Another way, if it's a community-based, you know, you want to mobilize the community and mobilize your leavers outside. I think the only thing that I would say across the board that I would probably apply, and obviously everything with some strategic input and be ready, flank yourself, be ready to mobilize allies and so on and so forth, is you have to defy. Mm-hmm. You have to defy these rules. There's no way around it but through, right? This is going to require a tremendous amount of disobedience in order to illuminate the illegitimacy of the mandates themselves.
Well, thank you so much, Nureth, for your time and your words and your tireless activism.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you for having me on and for all the brilliance you illuminate here. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much. And everyone follow Nura at 4 Nura, just the number 4 and then Nura. We'll put that in the description. Okay, thank you so much. Have a great night.
Bye-bye.
And that was amazing. And that was live. I saw some people in the chat saying, oh, 8 o'clock is late for a class. Nope. Not really. Not at some universities. I don't know why I sounded so testy just there. But anyway, it was live. And we are so thankful to Nura and also to the next guest, Jordan Sheridan. He is the co-founder of Status Quo. He is also obviously an investigative journalist. He is the producer of the documentary Flint Fatigue. And he is the author of the book, We the Poisoned, Exposing the Flint Water Crisis Cover-Up and the Poisoning of 100,000 Americans. So welcome, Jordan.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So Jordan, we're going to get into your book, but I thought it would be a good transition since we were just talking about more like national and international issues for us to start off with what is happening at the presidential election level. You basically had a thread that I can't find right now, but I had it before, and it's about how the Dems are not going to be able to deliver. They're not offering a good alternative to Trump. Kamala's not going to be moved left. Can you elaborate on those ideas? I can try to pull up your tweet as we're talking.
Yeah, I basically was saying that it feels like deja vu to 2020, where every kind of liberal and even progressives that I respect were, you know, saying, you know, forget everything else, just stop Trump. We'll deal with, we'll figure out moving back then Biden left after we stop Trump. And you're kind of hearing the same thing now where I ask people, all right, well, what's the strategy here to actually move Kamala Harris, who some think might be better than Biden on certain things, some say is more sympathetic than Biden to Palestinians. And I basically made the point, this is deja vu, because there is no strategy. There's no strategy among elected progressives. If you still believe AOC, the squad, fall into that category. I don't see a strategy among, you know, outside progressive groups to do aggressively hold Harris accountable. I don't see a strategy among labor, who obviously has been surging in the last year or two. It just seems like the strategy is, you know, stop Trump and we'll deal with everything else after. I don't actually think you can significantly move somebody like Biden or Harris to the left on anything substantial. Like, you're not getting Medicare for all. You're not getting, you know, a Green New Deal, free public college, something serious amidst a climate inferno. I think you're getting what we've gotten, which is kind of incremental crumbs. But part of why we can't get more is that the focus is just on electing Harris or stopping Trump rather than what are we going to do to actually organize to put pressure on if it's President Harris.
How do you think it would be smart to do that?
Well, for starters, you know, it's too late now, but I certainly don't know why, you know, Bernie, AOC, even the UAW and Sean Fain, who I have a lot of respect for. I covered the UAW strike. Just common sense. I mean, you don't just hand over your endorsement without anything in return. Bernie has done this over and over and over. They didn't even make her rhetorically promise anything substantial.
Right.
You know, she was kind of having to patch up the Titanic that was Biden. So there was leverage to make demands. You could have said, you need to be on the record that you're going to fight to raise the minimum wage to, let's say, $17 an hour. And you will not listen to a parliamentarian or whatever bullshit they come up with as an excuse. You could have got her on the record for a public option. It's not far enough, but it's better than nothing. None of that happened. I mean, Bernie kind of delayed endorsing her, but then endorsed her. Maybe they would respond, well, there's things happening behind the scenes that you don't know about. You know, that's infamously what AOC likes to say. But that would have been the starting point. You know, you want my endorsement? Make reasonable demands. You don't have to make her pledge Medicare for all, but reasonable things that were her and Biden's, what they ran on in 2020. The other thing is, you know, whether it be progressive groups, organized labor, the PRO Act. I mean, the PRO Act would do a lot more than Biden's symbolic walk on the picket line. Right now, if your audience doesn't know, General Motors just laid off 1,000 workers. Stellantis, which used to be Dodge, they're about to lay off 2,500 workers. And those are unionized workers that just got a new contract through the UAW. So, you know, Biden could show up on picket lines and cheers for that. Everybody loved that because of the symbolism. But without like federal laws making it easier to unionize, having actual penalties on these companies who, you know, break contracts, offshore jobs, you're not going to get much other than symbolism, and jobs are not secure, whether it's auto, Amazon workers, et cetera. So I think UAW should have, and any union endorsing her should have got her on the record that we're going to fight for the PRO Act in the first 100 days. They like to talk about the first 100 days. Your audience could say, well, she could say anything. I tell my audience this. Doesn't mean she's going to follow through. Of course. I mean, we cannot, you know, hold her down and make her sign it in blood. Because this is politics, but at least get her on the record. So then when she abandons it, you could try to apply pressure. None of that happened. And the other thing is, frankly, this is a longer term. I mean, Katie, I've seen you at protests that I've covered. I mean, I've been covering protests for 10 years. At a certain point, you need to change up your tactics. I'm not trying to condescend to protest groups, but, you know, in France, if they try to raise the minimum wage by, I don't know, 2 years. I mean, these people riot.
Right. The retirement age.
Right, right. They strike. Here, people, you know, obviously the ceasefire protests, which Status Quo has covered more than anyone, they're great, but obviously it has not changed much. I believe that all these activist groups, whether it's Black Lives Matter, climate, healthcare, you got to get serious about economically organizing, not just striking Amazon on the first day of the month, but actually having long-term economic boycotts. Obviously, that doesn't happen overnight. Obviously, you need to have a mutual aid pot, because if you strike Amazon, you don't want to hurt the workers on the floor. Because I think, you know, capitalism and the donors, they'll let you protest. And if you get a little too rowdy, they'll, you know, have their police force, the police, crack your skulls. But what they cannot stand is if you hurt their quarterly profits, if you hurt their ability to do stock buybacks. Everything is on a short-term, quarterly profits. And if there are economic protests, I mean, the Canadian protests that the truckers did, whatever you thought of that politically, because that had to do with COVID. I mean, they shut down a major bridge that was for commerce from the United States to Canada. And I mean, Trudeau, all of them freaked out because that was affecting the wallet. We're not doing that. The unions are, but the activists, aside from a few divestment campaigns for banking and this and that. So my thought is you got to start organizing, not just, you know, different protest routes and shutting down highways, but like, what can you do to actually hurt the donors? Because in my experience, how you move politicians is if you hurt their donors' wallets.
Wow. Well, you have to come back on because I want to pick your brain a lot more about your ideas. But we have other things to get to. So first, I want to show you, people have probably seen this, trigger warning, but here's, speaking of Kamala Harris not even paying lip service to making any changes, much less making the changes, here she is telling Dana Bash what she would do about Israel.
President Biden has tried unsuccessfully to end the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza.
Okay, first of all, as if he's tried. And also, anyone saying Israel and Hamas is a joke. The idea that this is Israel targeting an organization, a terrorist organization, as they would call it, which is, if you want to do that, fine, but make sure you say a much larger terrorist government is trying to target. They're not. We know this. This is a war on the people of Palestine. Anyway.
He's been doing it for months and months, along with you. Would you do anything differently? For example, would you withhold some U.S. weapons shipments to Israel? That's what a lot of people on the progressive left want you to do.
Let me be very clear. I'm unequivocal and unwavering in my commitment to Israel's defense and its ability to defend itself. And that's not going to change. But let's take a step back. October 7, 1,200 people were massacred. Many young people who were simply attending a music festival. Women were horribly raped. As I said then, I say today, Israel had a right, has a right to defend itself, we would. And how it does so matters. Far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed. And we have got to get a deal done. We were in Doha. Mm-hmm. We have to get a deal done. This war must end.
In the meantime.
And we must get a deal that is about getting the hostages out. I've met with the families of the American hostages. Let's get the hostages out. Let's get the ceasefire done.
But no change in policy in terms of arms and so forth.
No, we have to get a deal done. Dana, we have to get a deal done. When you look at the significance of this to the families, to the people who are living in that region, a deal is not only the right thing to do to end this war, but will unlock so much of what must happen next. I remain committed since I've been on October 8 to what we must do to work toward a two-state solution where Israel is secure and in equal measure the Palestinians have security and self-determination and dignity.
The two-state solution that Israel has said is not going to happen. Like, explicitly, we've known it wasn't going to happen, but they've explicitly said that. Yeah, so there's Kamala Harris, not even feeling pressure to pretend to have any difference with Joe Biden.
Listen, I mean, I was in Dearborn about a month ago speaking with folks. That's when a little bit after Biden dropped out. I got news for you. They're not voting for her. I can't speak for all Arab Americans, but I talked to a lot of people. And one woman said it best, your sympathy doesn't stop the bombs. And I also think that I tell my audience, and I think we should just be honest, people could call it anti-Semitic if they want. I happen to be Jewish, so I feel very, very easy saying this. Follow the donors. You know, Biden's top donors and now Harris's top donors. Jeffrey Katzenberg is like the co-chair of this campaign. His net worth is just under $1 billion. Ardent Zionist. Not only is he donating heavily to Harris, he is raising tens of millions, if not more, from other rich people. Chaim Saban, net worth $3 billion. I think he's the top donor to the Democrats, if I'm not mistaken, dating back to Bill Clinton. Hillary, he's given, Pelosi, all of them. Congress, Senate, many years ago, I think it was 2018, when the last time Israel was bombing Gaza, not to this degree, a couple Democratic senators kind of said something tepid, you know, pro-Palestinian, and he came down on them. They just happened to be taking his money, and they quickly reversed. The five-minute pause that Biden did when he was still running, I'm going to pause weapons. Chaim Saban, again, net worth $3 billion, sent a nasty letter to Biden's top aides, and Biden quickly reversed that. This is who's funding Harris's campaign. There's a lot of other, and it's not just sure. Jewish donors. There's a lot of donors that are not Jewish that are just Zionists and very ardently pro-Israel. But there's also a lot of top donors that are very, very wealthy. I mean, look, when Sheldon Adelson was alive, Republicans went to kiss his ring first, the casino, the rich casino guy. The New York Times had a story 2 weeks ago that his wife now is going to put in $100 million. And by the way, that's why Trump moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, because Sheldon Adelson, when he was alive, gave Trump $30 million. So bottom line, I mean, the media can, you know, cheer on her crocodile tears are a little better than Biden's, but she's not going to do anything because the money comes first. They believe they need to outraise Trump. I believe that's kind of fool's gold. Hillary Clinton in 2016 outspent Trump 2-1. Once the good vibes from the convention dissipate, which I believe they already are, it's not just Arab Americans. I mean, we've seen from the protests, a whole younger generation, I would say age 18 to 35, before October 7th, they were already softening on Biden, fleeing because of inflation, because of the student debt, climate. And even if AIPAC just goes bonkers on her, I do believe through if she changed her policy, you could have, I wouldn't say like a Bernie type small dollar engine, but her small dollar could really significantly move up, including progressives who maybe don't like her on other things, but, you know, support her for a little moral courage. I don't really think AIPAC could make the difference in 2 months. The donors might turn on her, but are they going to start running ads for Trump? I don't know about that, but I will say the economy and inflation is still the number one issue. So even if she turned on policy in a good way that we would like and your audience would like, I don't think Israel-Gaza in those swing states for most voters, I'm talking independents, the elusive swing voters, I don't think their vote is going to change based on whether she is calling for an arms embargo or not. I think it's really the young voters, not just young voters, there's older people that care about this too, but young voters, Arab Americans, I see there's more to gain for her because I don't see AIPAC money, like, you know, swinging all the independents against her. I see if there's a really, really, really bad economic event this month or October, that could. But on Israel-Gaza, I think that's the top issue for younger people, Arab Americans, not independent voters.
Okay. Now, you've been also doing a lot of interviews with third party. So you've interviewed Jill Stein, Cornel West, also interviewed Democrats like Marianne Williamson. What can you tell us right now about what is happening with third party voters and third party candidates? And you actually got an interesting scoop. We'll link it to it in the description, where Cornel West said that the Kamala Harris campaign had offered him something in exchange for his dropping out. So tell us about that and then the third party scene in general.
Well, first off, to your audience, I'm sorry to tell you, Santa's not real and we don't have a democracy. So that's
the flag behind me. Oh, Santa's not real. I thought you said Sanders is not real, which, yeah, would have also worked, yeah.
Santa's not real. We don't have a democracy. So all the fundraising emails, all the hysteria, there's no democracy to save. We have some democratic elements. But at the end of the day, I mean, they're literally spending hundreds of thousands of, actually millions of dollars to get Jill Stein. Even forget what you think. If you don't like Jill Stein, you like her. If you don't like, it doesn't matter. Even RFK. They're spending God knows how much money to stop competition, to stop democracy. So the democracy narrative and talking points is totally moot. Number two, you know, I saw AOC's little Instagram video. I got to tell you, I'm not like going to throw out Fraud Squad or anything like that. She's no longer my cup of tea. But boy, is that somebody who's really, really lost touch with how things really are. And what I mean by that, she's criticizing Jill Stein for showing up every 4 years, this and that, and not doing work on the ground. I've talked to Green Party people who said Jill Stein has helped them with their local campaigns, as well as other Howie Hawkins, et cetera, et cetera. But the media really matters. As somebody who's, you know, fought and clawed to build an independent media outlet, on a presidential, AOC had the benefit that she wasn't covered. So she was able to sneak through because her opponent at the time, Joe Crowley, was asleep at the switch. He wasn't campaigning. He just assumed he was going to win. If the media would have covered her more in that local New York 14 race, Crowley might have actually started carpet bombing her with ads. Jill Stein, for example, even Marianne Williamson running in the Democratic Party, it was a complete media blackout. And when the media did cover them, they say, well, she's not a credible candidate.
Not a serious candidate. Yeah.
Right. And at the end of the day, I mean, traveling as much as I do, the overwhelming majority of people are not like us. They're not living and breathing politics. They're not watching YouTube shows. Their news consumption and their political consumption is maybe local news or CNN or Fox or whatever for 10 minutes at night. Most people's consumption of what's going on, who the candidates are, when the primary is, comes from their local news and, you know, some people a little further than that, whether it's like NPR or CNN or whatever. So if you're not getting the fact that there even is a third party choice, if you don't know anything about them, not just Jill Stein, any of them, it's kind of hard to build a party. Sure. I'm not saying Jill Stein or Cornel West is perfect. I love Cornel West, but I would say he's probably a better revolutionary thinker than a politician. I think he would probably not even argue with that. I don't think he's run the best campaign, but Jill Stein, by the way, wasn't planning on running. She ran because Cornel West dropped out from the Green Party. So AOC just said a lot of things that have a lot of nuances to it. And she makes it sound like, oh, you know, these people are just losers who can't sway people. Most people don't even know they're an option. And until you address that inequality that is the media either blacking you out or totally smearing you. I mean, Marianne Williamson, I would argue, was more qualified to run than Pete Buttigieg was. She was a successful entrepreneur, author, had ties to Oprah. Pete Buttigieg was a small town mayor who did nothing other than gentrify. But boy, did the media prop him up. Marianne Williamson, they painted as a crystal lady. So I think, you know, I see in the left has been so fractured in this post-Bernie era between that rift between people who still want to, you know, try to do it within the Democratic Party versus people who say burn down the Democratic Party. We got to do it through a third party. And my stance has always been, I think we're arguing about the wrong thing because it's rigged either way. For those who think it's going to be easier or more virtuous to do it through a third party, maybe more virtuous, not easier. You could say what you want, but Bernie Sanders came a lot closer than any third party candidate has ever come doing it within the Democratic Party. So to me, until you address the systemic corruption and rot of the electoral system, of the public financing system, it's rigged to defeat third party candidates. I mean, honestly, Cornel West, they've been fighting to get him off the ballots. Jill Stein, the Biden's Treasury Department is withholding $300 worth of matching funds from her that she has qualified for, and the Federal Election Commission said she qualified for. We know what happened with Matthew Ho. He was an independent who ran in North Carolina. The Democrats were sending out fake robocalls.
Right, pretending to be the Green Party.
So I'm not saying don't try to build a third party, but you also shouldn't have illusions or be delusional that it's an easier road or more virtuous. And it's not just like find a more charismatic candidate. I think Cornel West is pretty damn charismatic. And right now he's floundering. Right now the system is corrupt. And if you don't have any way of combating what, you know, years ago when Nick Brana started his whole thing before all the other stuff with him, I asked him, what's your media strategy? Because I think 60% of a third party, you're going to have to break through local media, national media. No answer. And I think most of them don't have an answer.
Party.
Exactly. So to me, I can't blame Jill Stein for the Green Party. There's been a lot of disorganization in the Green Party. There's been a lot of disorganization in a lot of third parties. But at the end of the day, I don't know if any third party is going to be successful if you cannot get to the majority of Americans, A, that you exist, B, what you stand for, and then get to know you. Because Bernie, he rose in 2016 and 2020. The more people heard from him, right. The more people heard his message, the more popular he became. If you can't get your message out, you're kind of, you know, screwed.
Right. So shifting to a related topic, talking about how terrible our political system is and how corrupt it is and hopeless in many ways, let's talk about a book that's about that in large part. And that is your book, your new book, that's We the Poisoned, about the poisoning of Flint, Michigan. And tell us about how you decided to even follow this story and then just jump into it. I mean, it's great. I'm reading it now. It's very good. Tell us some of the most shocking, infuriating things about this cover-up.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a, it's like a never-ending onion that just when you think you've kind of peeled it all, there's more. I was on the campaign trail in 2016. I was kind of ping-ponging between Bernie and Trump, which was a whole, it was like going from Woodstock to like the Lion King when Scar took over the kingdom. And I was at the People's Summit in 2016, for those of you veterans who remember the good old days. And a Flint resident came up to me. I kind of knew what happened just from the news. This was after like Rachel Maddow went and did her town hall. But, you know, I was naive like a lot of people. And I figured, well, I'm assuming they're fixing this. She came up to me in a Flint Lives Matter shirt. She told me that it's a disaster, that the media has abandoned them, that people are starting to get really, really sick. And asked me to come. So, you know, I was at the Young Turks at the time. To their credit, to Jenk's credit, they sent me. And it was pretty immediate. I mean, I was there for like an hour. And I was like, this is like an episode of The Walking Dead. I was just meeting kids with rashes, meeting adults who were losing their hair, walking into homes with like everything was broke. The dishwasher was broken. The sinks were broken, anything with water, laundry machines were broken. And then it just kind of talking to people, I just couldn't believe that the media wasn't covering it anymore. I went back to the hotel that I was staying at and like it was the 2016 race and they were covering something crazy Trump tweeted. And that's kind of what like radicalized me a little bit because there's such an alternative reality between what is actually happening on the ground in places in America and what the corporate media covers. So I just kind of started going there. At first, I really wasn't thinking about it in terms of like investigative. I was thinking about it more like, let's show the human suffering. But I just started, you know, every trip I took over the last 8 years, I started building more sources. Those sources started dumping like a whole vault of corruption on me. This wasn't what the media was describing it as. The media had described this as some just tragic mistake because government officials were trying to cut corners and save money. No, I learned very quickly this was actually a for-profit privatization scheme. It's not just going on in Flint. It's happening everywhere. It's not just happening with water. It happens with a lot of utilities and public assets that are now being sold to private companies, predominantly water. And I learned that basically they created the... You want to talk about democracy for a second. Everything's hysterical about democracy. This is actually an example of democracy being removed, but you never hear this from Democrats ranting about democracy now. The governor of Michigan, who is a Republican, declared a financial emergency in Flint. Most people don't think he actually had to do that. And he just appointed unelected czars to run the city. And they took power over the elected mayor and city council that the Flint residents voted for. And the first order of business was, let's try and switch Flint to a brand new water system. Flint had gotten its water from Detroit, no problem, for 50 years. Detroit was price gouging them. So that was kind of the narrative from local officials, from the Republican governor and his people. Let's create our own water system so we could set our own rates. Okay, well, Flint, they said that new water system, we're going to build it along the same exact path as the existing water pipeline that went from Detroit to Flint. Unheard of in engineering terms to build like a duplicate pipeline. It just doesn't happen. And they were gonna bring raw water from Detroit to Flint. Well, you need a lot of raw water for fracking. You need a lot of raw water for farming, agriculture. Most of the water was not even going to be used for Flint residents. It was going to be used for business. So basically what happened is Flint was broke. Detroit was already bankrupt, but Flint was near bankruptcy. It had no credit rating. It wasn't legally allowed to borrow more money for anything, much less to build a completely unnecessary new water system. So Wall Street banks, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, along with local officials in Flint and these unelected czars, kind of came up with this cockamamie scheme. Well, let's just create an emergency so Flint would have an exception to borrow $100 million for this new water system. And hey, while we're building this new water system, let's use the Flint River, which General Motors, DuPont, Dow Chemical, every corporation you could think of have been dumping their shit in for 100 years. And oh, while we're at it, let's use the Flint water plant, which I would compare to these Boeing planes that are falling apart midair, or they're adding the parts mid-flight. The Flint water plant, as I show in my book, didn't even have the equipment to add the proper chemicals The media always says, oh, they didn't add the proper corrosion control chemicals. They didn't have the equipment in the plant to do that. They were moving people from the garbage department to the water department 2 weeks before the water switch. So the bottom line is, it was all a rush to basically build this new water system and, you know, to hell with these people. No, I don't think anybody like thought they were actively going to poison them, but I also don't think legally they were supposed to test the water for a year before sending it out. They didn't do that. So the book reveals...
They didn't care very much if they were going to poison them.
No. And what I've tried to, because, you know, water is not sexy, right? It's the same problem with climate change. They say, oh, Chris Hayes has said, I'd like to cover it, but it doesn't get ratings. And water to them isn't sexy. I think it's pretty sexy because it's like the number one thing you need to stay alive. So I think that's kind of important. But to what I've tried to impress upon people, including a lot of media editors, we could go on for days about the media and how they've totally buried this. And I have specific examples. But at the end of the day, this was not just about water. This was a massive for-profit privatization scheme. And as I exposed in the book, I mean, the governor had, like, think of like the Sopranos and Tony's like consigliere. The governor's consigliere, his right-hand man, was going around Flint offering sick residents payoffs to shut up. I have that in the book. The governor and his top people destroyed their phones right before the launch of the Flint criminal investigation. Can you imagine for a second the MSNBC meltdown? If there was evidence that Donald Trump, his health secretary, the CDC, that they just erased their phones and all of their messages for the months before COVID spread throughout the world.
The end of democracy.
No, but it happened in Flint. Literally, I had Mother Jones asking me, is there a Trump angle? When I pitched that to them, I said, no, this happened under Obama. There's no Trump. You want me to make one up? So, I mean, the media on this is still deplorable. I'll tell you about that in a second. Political payoffs, destruction of evidence, witness tampering, residents, like the top activists, like think like an Erin Brockovich back in the day. The Erin Brockovich of Flint had her brakes cut and she almost died. You know, I have evidence that the governor of Michigan knew about the deadly Legionnaires outbreak, which is basically a bacterial water pneumonia. It's born from bacteria in water. He knew about it for 16 months. And instead of notifying the public and saving lives, he buried it because he wanted to run for president in a time far, far before Donald Trump ever ran. This was like 2014. There's evidence of witness tampering, political payoffs, threats and surveillance of residents. I also got the former governor's, his under oath testimony from 2020 that's never been released, where he's literally perjuring himself. He's contradicting what he told Congress. This is a bipartisan affair. So for those of you who are going to be like, but what about Obama? What about the Democrats? Democrats are in on this too. So I reveal in the book that, you know, Gretchen Whitmer, who when the media was trying to push out Biden, you know, a lot of people were pushing for her to replace Biden on the ticket. She's totally screwed Flint. The Democratic Attorney General of Michigan, Dana Nessel, who is beloved on MSNBC. She's on there all the time because she's going after the Trump fake electors. She pretty much tanked the Flint criminal investigation. Some people think intentionally to protect the banks that were involved with the cover-up. I can't get in her head, but she made decisions that make no sense. And it's in the book. Lawyers have said she obstructed the investigation from the start. She fired prosecutors that were going after the Republican governor for involuntary manslaughter, which would have been a first in American history. She fired them. She dropped charges. Her predecessors, they were building a case for racketeering, which is RICO. That was created in the 70s to go after the mob figures. Mm-hmm. They were like very close to charging that. She fired them and never followed through. And right now, like why I say this is still going on, it's an active cover-up. After the investigation ended, because for those that don't know, the Michigan Supreme Court threw out the criminal charges that were brought by the Democratic Attorney General. They ruled in a 6-0 decision. So it wasn't just Republican judges, it was liberal judges too, that basically they brought them against the Michigan Constitution because she's a dummy. And essentially, after the investigation was over, they had been refusing to hand over documents about that RICO investigation to me, claiming there was an active investigation. So once the investigation was over, I put in more Freedom of Information requests. Then they said, we don't have the documents. Well, I knew from sources that they did have the documents, and there were receipts showing that they had the documents. So then I publicly threatened to sue them, and magically they got back to me unprompted saying, we'll look again. Then they found the documents, but they won't give them to me. And I believe they won't give them to me because they expose JP Morgan and Wells Fargo's role in this. I have in the book emails, including JP Morgan executives. JP Morgan and Wells Fargo, by the way, were sued in 2020 civilly on behalf of 2,500 Flint children because they didn't, part of the deal, financial deal, was they were supposed to make sure the Flint plant could treat the water. Obviously, they didn't do that. So, you know, I try to tell people, you know, it's in this media environment, and obviously you know this, it's very hard to get people to care about something that happened 10 hours ago, much less 10 years ago. I mean, when I cover stories on Flint, it's instantly dead in the water on YouTube. Yeah. Not because people don't care, but it just YouTube will not elevate that kind of stuff. Neither will whatever the hell X and Twitter is these days. It's just Facebook. So it's been an uphill climb to get people to realize, A, this is not like crisis in the past tense. The water is still bad. I was just there. I've been there over 20 times. I did a book event in Flint. Literally, residents are coming up to me online to get signatures showing me rashes they still have on their arm from the water. Residents are still posting brown water they're getting 10 years later. Cancer is through the roof in Flint. An NYU toxicologist did a study. Some cancers are up 300% compared to before the water switch. All the criminal charges were dropped. They don't have Medicare for all. So, you know, it's just human nature. Perfect. Real quick. I went to East Palestine, Ohio, because we've been covering that too. That's kind of
another
like,
not sexy story. It's so depressing. Yeah. No, because I've tried to do shows on this too. The same thing. The numbers just aren't good. It's really depressing. Yeah.
It's kind of like it's similar to Flint, different starting point, but they're using the same playbook they did to cover up Flint there. And I interviewed a resident there, and I told her, "Oh, I'm on my way to Flint to cover the 10-year anniversary." And she said, "You know, I just thought they were fixing that because I never saw it in the news. I thought it was fixed. That's what people think." I mean, forever, people thought Love Canal was better because right. It just, you know, so that's kind of like the uphill climb being like an independent journalist, period. I'm sure Abby Martin has felt this way before October 7th, trying to get people to care about Gaza before this happened. And that's kind of been my uphill climb to get people to care about this. It's not particularly easy to promote or sell a book in the middle of an election, but that's how the cookie crumbled. But if people want, like, I've actually had conservatives reach out to me that read this, like, outraged. This is the one issue, and I've tried to tell this to, like, editors and media. Like, this is the one experience in my interview. Like, I have reported on Texas ranches interviewing, like, AR-15-wielding, like, rock rib Republicans, and they are fighting their city because their water is contaminated. Right. And the city's corrupt and doing nothing. I have interviewed like tree hugging hippies. The water, like, is people say, well, every issue could be politicized. Well, this one, like, you kind of need it. And most people that are not crazy don't think anyone should be poisoned and don't think the government should be trying to make a quick buck over water. So I hope people get the book because A, it's important. But B, if you don't know what they did in Flint, you will not have the playbook for your community because. Yeah. Whether it's water, whether it's air pollution, soil, fracking, mining, I mean, so many industrial, environmental, what I believe is environmental genocide going on in America. If you don't know what's still happening in Flint, good luck if it happens to you.
Well, I actually want to ask you about the issue of water privatization. I'm going to quote your book. You write, in 2020, water began being traded as a commodity on Wall Street, just like gold and oil. From hedge fund titans to local governments, water stocks are being bought up as a financial bet that there will be a shortage in the near future. Besides the moral depravity of corporate vultures and governments turning a basic human right into just another trade for profit asset, I can't say their predictions are wrong. Between record global droughts and epidemic of contaminated water across the country and world, and the climate catastrophe already destroying countries and communities, the future of clean and available water is not certain. In fact, 2/3 of the world's population will face water shortages by 2025. So can you talk more about this and what is happening regarding these laws now and the impact of these companies going in and buying up water rights? Because that's terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, that's, we go back to privatization. So in the Northeast, for example, where we are, American Water, which is a private water company, has taken over, they've taken over New Jersey's water for the most part, a lot of New York's water, other states' water, and private companies owning water, Wall Street hedge fund people and traders like that, because they know if you're a private company rather than a public utility, there's less regulations you have to follow. There's less testing you have to do. Even public utilities, by the way, I mean, Michigan, Flint, public utilities game the system, cherry pick testing, cheat on testing, but private companies are worse. So basically, because mixed the drought with all the water issues there has been, Wall Street hedge funders, traders in 2020 started buying up water, treating it as a commodity, because what if war's been fought over? At least Trump was honest, steal the oil if you're going to go to war. It's been oil. Well, a lot of people believe, whether it's a shortage or you know, regional conflict, the next world war could be over water, because it's not just a shortage of actual drinking water, it's a shortage of clean water. I mean, you have water in Gaza, it's contaminated. It's undrinkable. Same thing in Africa. There is water to drink, but it's contaminated. And you could die from that. I mean, people who have drink contaminated water, you could get E. coli, die from horrible diarrhea, not to TMI.
Cholera,
Legionnaires. And also, it's not just the acute. More people are getting sick from these PFAS, which are known as the forever chemicals. Right. That is not just a Flint problem, but that's having real issues for reproductive issues, miscarriages, issues at birth. With children with deformities because of PFAS, cancers. So basically, Wall Street is betting on our fucked up system, and private companies, and Aaron Bakovich has been screaming about this for 30 years, are buying up a lot of water. By the way, when you see ads this election about the historic infrastructure deal, look underneath the hood. The American Prospect wrote a lot about this. The infrastructure deal was a big privatization scheme. Yeah, they're building roads, but a lot of the infrastructure deal was selling off public systems, water systems, wastewater, other public assets to private companies. And I do not want my daughter's water being, dictated by Goldman Sachs or, you know, whatever vulture corporate company that's buying up the stocks. So people need to be worried about that, because at the end of the day, it's already, you know, Africa and so many other third world countries have water shortages. But in America, I mean, your Jackson, Mississippi, for example, they have water shortages all the time because the water pressure is too low or too high. There's other communities in America that don't get media coverage that have undrinkable water. I mean, Josh Shapiro, when they were, you know, kind of dangling him for a potential VP spot, it wasn't mentioned in the corporate media that there is a Dimmick, I think it is, in Pennsylvania, a city without clean water, that he has not followed through on his promises to help them. I was down in coal country, West Virginia. They're getting green water with algae coming out. It was barely covered. Only just started being covered a year into it. And that's the coal baron governor of West Virginia, Jim Justice and Joe Manchin, have done nothing about it. So there is so many hot spots around America with water contamination. It's not all lead. There's arsenic problems in people's water, PFAS, bacteria, Legionnaires, chromium, chloroform. And by the way, you could replace every lead pipe today, and that would not completely fix it, because we have an EPA, but we don't actually have an EPA with teeth. We have Wall Street regulators, they're not allowed to fully regulate. I give you the 2008 crash. So if corporations are going to be indefinitely allowed to dump their shit everywhere and anywhere, and that shit either directly goes into our drinking water sources or indirectly, lakes, reservoirs, ponds, rivers, it's going to come to you. People, I don't want to tell people to freak out, but don't just trust that your water is fine. You know, do independent research.
Let's actually watch. I want to show a trailer from your book and then a trailer from this documentary that you produced and are in called Flint Fatigue. Let's start with the trailer for your book.
biggest government cover-up of the 21st century.
What do you call a decade of repeated Watergates, repeated times that they're actually trying to, how I feel, kill us off?
None of the facts have been disputed. Aaron Brockovich actually said, this is the biggest cover-up you'll ever read.
And, 6 months after the water switch, my throat started bothering me. So I went for a biopsy. Long story short, it was aggressive throat cancer.
And justice delayed has been justice denied.
Yeah, the brown water coming out of there. And, you know, in the bathroom.
And the youngest suicide victim, 5 years old. We talk about the effects, the effects of lead. It affects your brain. It affects your mentality.
It's been 8 years, man. It's been eight fucking years. I can't take it. And if I die because of this, I'm dead. I'm dead. But someone's got to speak it up.
What I can do is, at the very least, expose what was done to these people, the details, the who, what, when, why. Maybe it could help them fight it elsewhere.
Okay, and now let's play, because this is obviously a related story.
I just want to mention to you, three of the people that spoke in there have died within the last 2 years. So
which ones?
Tony, who said it's 8 years. If I die, I die. He died. Virginia, who was showing the rashes fresh on her skin, and the woman who got aggressive throat cancer.
Wow, I'm not surprising. That's so awful. And well, before I show that, can you talk about this suicide, the 5-year-old suicide case?
Yeah, honestly, I never learned what actually happened. I was kind of shocked by that, because how does a 5-year-old actually know, like, how to do something right to themselves? So I don't know exactly what happened with that. But that bishop has basically been on the leading the fight. And she has focused a lot on her grandson, other kids, because they were all basically poisoned and their brains were forever altered when they were between 5 and 12. And 10 years later, you're now a teenager, and you are now, because lead screws up your brain,
right,
you now have violent mood swings, crime is through the roof, but the police don't treat them any differently.
Right.
So, right. And you know, they are now flunking out of school, can't hold a job because their attention spans, you know, are like very thin. So with the 5-year-old, I don't know specifically what happened, but I have heard of young people, you know, biggest government, 12, 13, killing themselves.
Okay, let's watch the trailer for Flint Fatigue.
What matters right now is this, that Flint River right there is still right there. Okay. And those people that are victims of what was played on them are still victims. The 7,000 babies are still brain damaged. You fucked up. The fact of the matter is now. What do you do about it now? You left a lot of people dead and laying in the street, and you still got people dead and laying in the street. Excuse my French.
They told us we were disposable. That's what they told us, is that we are disposable people.
You think this will ever be fixed?
No. And, you know, I'm never going to see my baby again. And they're never going to see their loved ones again. And I don't know how to deal with that.
These aren't all elderly people. We're talking people in their 40s, 50s.
We're talking about 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
I'm talking about, I know a young girl have breast cancer. 8 years old.
My grandson, he was no longer an AB student, but a DEF student.
Year 10 of the water crisis. And my 8th year of covering this, I first went to Flint in 2016. And I guess we should start from the beginning.
3, 2, 1.
What is happening here in Genesee County? And is this cancer crisis connected to the water switch? Newly released data from the health department reveals cancer rates here significantly higher than anywhere else in the state of Michigan.
It's the 10-year anniversary of the Flint water crisis, and it's not something from the past.
So, yeah, both of those works, both the book and the documentary, I really recommend. Final question for you, Jordan. Can you explain to us why Obama did what he did in Flint, Michigan? I'll never forget. I had not heard about this until I saw the Michael Moore film, Fahrenheit 11/9, I believe. And for people who don't know, and we can't show it because we get a copyright infringement, if we do. But Obama basically took a little sip of the water and told people he probably drank a little lead when he was a kid. Can you tell people why he did that? I couldn't believe that.
Well, I can't say for my reporting, but Michael Moore swears that that was not Flint water and it was water from Air Force One. So that's what Michael Moore says. I wasn't there. But listen,
I mean, what his motive in sanitizing, yeah, for lack of a better word, Flint water was.
I can't get in Obama's head. I don't think Obama... it would be the easy answer to say Obama was like nefarious in this and he was one of the worst. I think Obama just frankly didn't care. I don't think he was that involved. And I think Obama's mind operated on meritocracy, and he trusted the EPA. He trusted his EPA chief that the numbers that he was being given and the picture that he was being given, that the situation was improving and they're starting to replace the pipes and they're passing around filters that were the filters were a joke. They went bad very quickly. But I really think Obama truly believed that he trusted his EPA. I don't think Obama woke up saying, you know what, they're still being poisoned, but I'm just going to cover it up.
Yeah.
And this is coming from someone who's, I'm not an Obama fan. Right. I think he genuinely just trusted the people around him. I think the EPA was spineless. They were not the chief culprits of the cover-up, but they say silence is complicity. They knew about the toxic water for at least a year and a half and hid behind bureaucracy that legally they weren't sure if they could step in and take over for the Michigan government. Bottom line, I also think Obama just thought his charm and general bullshit would soothe the people of Flint. I think that, again, I can't get in his head, but Flint is majority Black, so they did love Obama. So maybe he thought like, oh, I'll just go assure them this and that. But the people I talked to in Flint, you mentioned Obama to them, to this day, they're angry about that. Because Democrats can be condescending, period. But imagine if you're like poison struggling people, right, and the guy comes here like, hey, look, the water's fine. And I drank a little lead and I'm fine. This isn't a little lead, first of all. But I wish I could give you a psychoanalysis. Yeah. I think that Obama was basically just asleep at the switch, not just in Flint. A lot of communities, majority Black, that had a lot of hope for Obama. But at the end of the day, why I tell people, because it's, everyone's tribal. Most people put on their team blue or team red hat. I think you, I, and a few others are not that. And we kind of just call them all corrupt. But most people in America are very tribal. But I really hope people realize with things like this, it's not just Republicans did this and Democrats versus Democrats did this. The color is not blue or red. It's green. This is a for-profit privatization scheme. Republicans presided over the cover-up. They set this horrible train in motion, and they were conducting it as it poisoned people. But the Democrats ran. Gretchen Whitmer ran on justice for Flint. She ran on, I'm going to reopen the free water stations that her predecessor shut down. She's done none of it. The Democratic Attorney General is currently, as we speak, burying this. She will not give me the documents that I believe will expose the biggest financial fraud in American history. And for the record, this is the real Watergate. For the older fogies that watch CNN and think Watergate is like the biggest government cover-up, Watergate was child's play. It was
Didn't kill anyone.
It was a few knuckleheads breaking into an office. If it wasn't the president's involvement, no one would care.
Right.
This is Watergate because it's actively killing people. That's the worst part of this. We don't know how many people died from this. The state of Michigan put out bullshit numbers, but every time I go there, I hear about more people dying of cancer, liver failure, kidney failure, rare cancers, and that's not added to the death count. People need to read this because if you honestly believe democracy is on the line in the 2024 election, I want you to read this to know we don't have a democracy, because in a democracy, if you vote for people who are supposed to represent you and those people, whether it's intentional or just gross negligence, harm you, they're supposed to then make it try to remedy the situation. They're supposed to then make you as whole as possible, even though you can't make someone whole who's been permanently damaged. In this case, you literally have officials on both sides, both parties, covering the whole thing up. And by the way, the media is in on it. I expose in the book examples of local media that killed stories about the deadly Legionnaires outbreak. They had documents showing there was a deadly waterborne outbreak going throughout Flint 6 months after the water switch. They just didn't run it. I have other stories of media just choosing not to run stories that would have been a public notification to residents. So there's a lot of complicity, government, media, and I hope people read it because it's really important we get these things out. Not every book could be about Trump. So give yourself a break and read about good old government corruption.
Question for you from a viewer. What are credentialed biostatisticians and epidemiologists crunching the numbers on these cases, finding IRT, the clustering, et cetera?
So I've talked to toxicologists at NYU, Langone, which is one of the better schools in the country, particularly for toxicology. Talked to Judith Levine, who's a renowned toxicologist. Talked to cancer doctors. So I probably talked to several cancer doctors, the pediatrician, the hero pediatrician in Flint. Her name was Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. She's the one who basically blew this wide open because she found the high lead levels in children's yeah. blood lead levels. People who have independent researchers, not EPA funded, not government funded, they have found a whole lot more that was in that Flint water than what the EPA says, including PFAS, including diesel fuel. So yeah, if you want to email me, jordancharidan@statuscoup.com, and I could send you those links.
Okay, great. So last two things I'm going to do. Read this comment. Gaza shows exactly how much the big political donors care about our health and safety. Poisoning us shouldn't be a surprise. Well said. And now Brad actually found the Obama video that he found an AP version of it. So we're just going to watch that, and then we will say goodnight to everyone. And thank you all for tuning in. And Jordan, of course, sit back, relax, and watch this clip.
Thank you, press. I will see you again in the larger rally. It is. There you go. You know, generally, I have not been doing stunts here, but, you know. And this used a filter. You know, the water around this table, you know, was Flint water that was filtered. And it just confirms what we know scientifically, which is that if you're using a filter, if you're installing it, then Flint water at this point is drinkable.
All right.
So that one actually wasn't the one when he was in Flint.
Yeah.
But it's a perfect encapsulation of what I was trying to say, because he has the EPA chief next to him. He's saying, you know, scientifically it's drinkable. Right. So he just kind of bought what he was being sold. But that doesn't excuse the fact that he didn't dig deeper. I mean, this is an American city that was poisoned. At the time, it was 100,000 people. He just said, oh, my EPA says it's getting better. They're handing out filters, which these are not like reverse osmosis systems, which spend thousands, cost thousands. These were flimsy filters that go bad. And you cannot use for hot water, only cold water. And they help reduce lead, but they breed bacteria. So there was a whole lot of problems. And Trump, by the way, didn't do anything either. So it goes both ways.
Yeah. Well, Jordan, thank you so much. And I really recommend the book. And check Jordan's show out, Status Quo. Check his book out and check out the documentary.
Thanks so much, Katie. I really appreciate you having me.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. Have a good night. So that was a great show, guys. Thank you so much to Noura Erekat. Thank you to Jordan Charidan. Thank you to Brad. Thank you to Phantom Esfanta. Thank you to Tyler. Thank you to Nathan. We will see you next week. Please make sure that you subscribe. Become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, this week, we're keeping everything public because I think both of these stories are really, really, really important. But next week, we will have some Jeremy Corbyn for you, dear Patreon viewers. And I think that's all I have to say. Bye, everyone, and see you next week.